Welcome to the Procurement Show.
Hello and welcome to the Procurement Show, the show that tackles the topics we all need to think about and sets out to explore the more interesting bits of procurement. I'm Jonathan O'Brien.
And I'm Paul Philpott. My role here is to ask random questions, but also get very excited about any show that involves eating. And this one involved eating.
This one does involve eating. And we're super excited because not only do we have a supply of Tony's Chocolonely here in the studio, but also to welcome our next guest.
The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organisations around the globe.
For years, the cocoa industry has been associated with exploitation and poor practice. 60% of the world's cocoa comes from Ghana and the Ivory Coast. And here, more than 1.5 million children in cocoa-growing households are involved in child labour. 30,000 people are victims of forced labour and 60,000 hectares of tropical forest have been cleared for cocoa production in the last 5 years. Tony's Chocolonely has made it their mission to change this and change chocolate. And today, our guest is going to share how they've done this. He's been a senior advisor to McKinsey, CPO at Mars Wrigley, CPO of Coty, and today he is Chief of Impact and Operations at Tony's Chocolonely. Please welcome to the Procurement Show live from Amsterdam, Pascal Boultersen. Pascal, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much, Jonathan and Paul. Really happy to be here.
Let's talk about sustainability. Why is chocolate not sustainable? And how do you begin to make it so, Pascal?
I think it's the facts that you've highlighted already is that an enormous amount of chocolate is produced in West Africa. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the circumstances that the smallholder farmers are experiencing are not great. Besides the fact that 60% of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa, but 98% of the world's cocoa is produced by smallholder farmers. Anywhere around the world, you will not see a lot of very large cocoa farmers. And these smallholder farmers are incredibly vulnerable. They're vulnerable because nobody's really looking out for them. The price that they're getting paid is too low, and they're in areas where there is very little support for them to send their children to school or for them actually to have the opportunity to thrive. So I think the world of cocoa and the world of chocolate is hence not very sustainable, because if you look at most of the metrics that we would all have around either deforestation or social circumstances in which that cocoa is produced, or the economic circumstances under which that cocoa is produced, is not up to today's standard.
It's really thought-provoking to hear the true story behind chocolate, and I think we're going to learn a lot during today's interview. Obviously, Tony's Chocolonely has taken the lead here very much. You've already started to summarise exactly what you're doing. But it raises the question as to why all the other chocolate brands aren't doing the same thing. Why isn't everyone doing that? You know, when it comes to making something like chocolate, how much is it down to what you have to do as a business, such as meeting legislation, versus what you choose to do? And as a brand, as a manufacturer, how far are you willing to go?
Yeah, I think let's start with the beginning. If you look at those cocoa farmers, as you've already said, there's about 2.5 million cocoa farmers. There's about, reported in West Africa alone, almost 1.6 million children of those cocoa farmers are working on those cocoa farms, out of which 95%, so let's say more than 1.5 million children, are working, doing work that is classified by the ILO as illegal child labors or worst forms of child labor.
Wow.
This data has not changed in the last 20 years. It's been reported on by external institutes, first by the Tulane University and latest by the NORC Institute. Those numbers have not changed. So every time we go back in and people start investigating those numbers, actually those numbers have gone up because cocoa production has gone up. Now, a lot of companies have pledged to resolve these issues, as far as to go to the US Senate has been involved. I mean, companies around the world have pledged to start to produce sustainable cocoa. But the essence of the story is that for those smallholder farmers, the smallholder farming families at scale, nothing has changed. Yeah, it's a real good question. Like, how can that be? How can it be that the systemic changes that these smallholder farmers are facing are not being faced by the large companies, by people that are trading into their cocoa? And why is that not more public outcry? Now, if you Google on public outcry, there's been reporter after reporter that has gone in and has reported about these issues for many years, but it has not changed. So the fact is that there is a systemic problem around the ownership of that. And I think it first starts with the fact that there is a lot of intransparency in the system. People can hide or do not know exactly which cocoa farmer is producing for the cocoa, the chocolate bar that they are making, because the chocolate is not fully segregated. So as a Tony's company, we've said one of the first things that you need to solve is you need to have a segregated supply chain where we are very clear that every farmer that works in our supply chain, we know them. We know their family size, we know the plot size, we know where the location of the farm is. We also know how much money they make and how much money they get from us. So you start then looking at family houses, you're looking at household member sizes, but you have to, as a company, take ownership of people that are not in your first tier supply chain, right? Yep. And this is German show, and you can talk about first tier supplier, yep, second tier, yep, supplier, third tier supplier, and so on. That is also the problem. If you don't go to the root of the problem, which is smallholder farmers left in desperate situations, if you're not willing to tackle that as a company, then it's very easy to make an argument around why you're not directly accountable for the circumstances in which these smallholder farmers live.
Managing a supply chain to that extreme must come at quite an overhead.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's hard enough to understand your tier one supplier.
Yeah.
Then you go tier two, tier three, tier four, and so on back to the original producers and the original raw material, where you have no contractual relationship and who probably don't really want you interfering to a certain degree. And that becomes really difficult. So I'm really intrigued by this point, because we know that there's child labor that sits within this industry. And what is astonishing is that Tony Cioccoloni seems to have really made some really good, strong inroads into this. And you just said you've got to understand your tier two, tier three, you've got to get there. Is that how you fix child labor, or is there more to it than that?
It's a bit more to it. So the company is founded, and you're a procurement socio, you're going to like this. It's founded on five sourcing principles. Mm-hmm. And those five sourcing principles are our working Bible, if you would say it in a non-religious way. As I said, the first thing that is in our principle is traceability. And that traceability means you need to know who you're working with on the ground, which farmer. Our second principle is that we believe farmers are stronger together, and they're better together when they're organized into a cooperative that will look out for those farmers collectively, like many agricultural supply chains have been organized in that way for the last couple of hundred years. Mm-hmm. So we believe in the principle of strong farmers. We believe in a principle of quality and productivity, because the more you can produce by good effort, the more those farmers will be able to make money. The fourth principle that we're using is long term. And you've had a really good point there around what is your contractual obligation. So what we do is we commit ourselves to these cooperatives for 5 years. And that means we invest in them, we build with them, we support them, and we grow with them. And our commitment to them is that we will buy as much as we can buy and as much as they're willing to sell to us. And they have zero commitment to us. They only can sell to us if they want to sell to us, mm-hmm, and if we're the best buyer in the place. Because if you want to change this relationship of the chocolate companies has the money and has the power versus the co-op and the farmer doesn't have the power, you need to change that relationship. So we're putting all the power and all the decision rights in the hands of these cooperatives. But what they're getting from us is a long-term investment and long-term agreement that we will buy as long as they can make it and we have the demand, and we will buy their cocoa. And then last but not least, and clearly, when you're dealing with farmers that are in extreme poverty, you have to solve poverty. So in a way, what we're doing is we pay what is called a living income reference price. So when the price of cocoa is below what we deem and what we have calculated should be a living income reference price together with fair trade, then we top that up. So we give directly to those cooperatives and the farmers additional money for the cocoa that they deliver to in our supply chain.
Wow.
And what we see is that when you do those five things, the results are amazing. And for me, I can say right now that I think child labor in these circumstances is a solvable problem. So what we see today in the data, we track and monitor the data quite diligently, is that in some of our best performing co-ops now, child labor prevalence, which means the percentage of mm-hmm. cases in which we go and visit these farmers every year and sometimes more than once a year, we see about 1.7% of prevalence rate. So sometimes children are still working on farms, but we don't want them to work on farms. But that is a hell of a lot better than the 50% that we normally see. And that is what the industry sees. So in mm-hmm. every industry you'll find, or in every chocolate company, the moment they start working with these farmers, 50% of those children are working illegally in cocoa. And what we see is by doing these things for a couple of years, child labor prevalence rate almost go down with 95%.
Wow, that's incredible. Let's just pause for a minute, just for that bit to sink in. That is the roadmap to eliminate child poverty in the supply chain, in an industry where big, big companies have not done that. And there is the way that you do it. Tony Cioccolone have pioneered how you eradicate child labor in the supply chain.
But what's even more shocking, Jonathan, is that those big companies are big brands,
yeah.
Heritage brands. I'm not going to name them, but
we all know who they are. Yeah.
And they just simply don't seem to care.
I wouldn't want to speculate on why.
No, I know.
But there is the roadmap for how companies can eradicate child labour in the supply chain.
It's difficult when you hear the alternative way. I want to unpick what you've said a bit more, most certainly from the financial point of view. I would guess consumers and lay person like myself would think that if we pay more for a product, we are helping. But how do you actually regulate and control that the money you pass down through your supply chain actually makes its way to where it's needed most and doesn't get intercepted by greedy people?
It's very polite.
Yeah, that's a very nice way of putting it. So we actually get invoiced directly by the cooperatives. For some of the premiums, we pay directly to the cooperatives, and then they distribute that to the farmers that in their supply. Now, the cooperative is owned by the farmers, right? So they self-regulate. We do financial controls, and we do controls on how the money flows and where the money flows. What we do not do is we do not get involved in the actual bean flow and the ownership of the beans, which you can do, but we're just not financially big enough and sturdy enough as an organization to do that. So we don't take ownership of the intermediate product. But what we do is we do the payments directly to the cooperative so that they can run the programs on supporting farmers with additional labor. So these intervention packages that we provide to farmers cost a lot of money, right? So we help these children when we find child labor. We identify what is the root cause and why is that child doing something on that farm? And then you have to remediate that. And per family, that will be different because nobody doesn't want to send their kids to school. There's nobody in the planet that wants to have that child do illegal labor. So there is no bad farmer in the world. What there are is people in desperate need of support on how do you start fixing this and what is needed. And that can be providing a bicycle for a kid to go to school because they can't walk it. That can be supporting the community to build a school. That can be around helping the farmer with labor on the farm so that there's no need for the child to do the labor, right? So there's many different things that we do to intervene and to help the farmers on the remediation of the issue. And clearly that costs money. And that money that those farmers need, we send directly through the farmers, through the cooperatives.
The Procurement Show, exploring the more interesting bits about procurement. And now, the procurement fun fact. This edition's exciting tale of preposterous procurement, bizarre buying, or simply saucy sourcing.
It's a little known fact that the return of Donald Trump to the Oval Office has a close link to procurement.
So little, I didn't know that. Really?
The word procurement, in fact. Because if you rearrange the letters in the word procurement, you get Trump Encore.
Just think. Ooh,
spooky, eh? Mm.
The procurement fun fact. Contact us by email. hello@theprocurementshow.com. Send us a tweet @procurementshow or connect with us on LinkedIn. Search for The Procurement Show.
Do you ever encounter any friction points politically?
Less and less so. So I think clearly Tony's is a very outspoken brand. As you can imagine, not everybody likes our message. And we believe that in order to change the industry, you need to be outspoken and you need to highlight the issues. And clearly, not all the companies that we're competing on shelf with like our message because we're putting the finger on some of the difficult subjects that people have been trying to work on, but have not been able to solve for the last 20 years. And the same for, I would say, governments, right? It's quite difficult to understand what's really going on in a country, and you don't really want to touch the autonomy of a country. And clearly, when things are illegal, I mean, the same in the UK or in the Netherlands or in the US, we are very clear there are things happening in some countries that are also illegal according to some modern standards. And there's not a country in the world that wants to completely recognize that.
I'm interested in how you actually understand what happens right back at the growers, because you painted this picture of needing to get right back, understand, work with, ensure that people receive, you use a different word, the living wage, the living equivalent.
Living income reference, yeah.
Thank you. So how can you know what actually happens back at the growers? Because prior to doing procurement, I used to be a supplier auditor. So I used to visit companies all over the world And what would happen is you'd arrive and they would show you the things they want to see, and all the bad stuff would have been taken away, and the people that weren't supposed to be there would have left by the back door.
But you are really, really good with the clipboard.
Yeah, I'm really good with the clipboard. And I looked really important carrying it around as well. But the thing is, you never quite get to see what really happens when you leave. So how do you overcome that? How can you really know what's happening?
I think the first thing is, when you show up, how do you create trust in the relationship and that you're not there to punish people? And I think it's when you used to go visit companies and you would audit them, they would be fearful, right? Because their fear is, oh, they might find something that is not okay and then I'm going to get punished. So what you have to take away is the fear that if we find something, we don't punish, we embrace it and we work together to a solution. And I think that is answer one. So you have to build trust. Mm-hmm. And we're working with smallholder farmers in communities, with cooperatives and with farmer and with villages. And so you have to start building a trusting relationship that you're there to help. You're not there to pass judgment or to ask to do something that they would normally not do. What you want to understand is, what is the real situation? The second thing is, we do show up in every farming household every year. So all of the farmers, we have 35,000 farmers. We visit all those farming families once a year.
You actually visit the families' homes?
Yeah, we visit the family's home. We talk to the parents, whether the farmer is the wife or the husband. We talk to the children. We talk to everybody that lives in the household. And as you can imagine, if I would show up to your house, you would not be very welcoming of letting me in and talking about what your kids are doing if you have.
That applies to everyone. Trust me, he doesn't let anyone in.
Not without my clipboard, anyway.
So I think that's always a delicate situation, right away, where you can't be saying that you have the right to come in. No, you have to ask for permission and you have to make them understand, like, why do you want to ask some questions and who do you want to talk to? And I think once they understand and once you build that trust, you know, it literally opens the doors of people to come in. And once they see that we can help them and provide support, suddenly the doors go open very quickly and they say, oh yeah, you're back in. Oh, thank you. Come back in and I'll talk to you about what we've done in the last year.
But in between all this, do you have any additional form of measurement and data gathering and ways that you assess and measure your suppliers? How can you rely on the data that you're gathering?
Yeah, the data is gathered through ICI, which is a cocoa initiative. Also, what we do, it's a program called CLMRS, Child Labor Monitoring and Remediation. We haven't invented that system. That system has been around for many years. What we're just doing is we're executing it with incredible rigor. So the data is then collected and we validate the data, all of the data that we collect. So we do polygon mapping. So we go around the farm and we look at what is the size of the farm, what are the GPS locations of that farm. And we do that today for more than 30,000 farmers. We look at the household size, we look at all that data, we collect all that data and we store that. And then we also look at the physical bean flow. So the beans that they produce, they go into our system called Bean Tracker, and we actually start tracking the deliveries of those farmers into our supply chain. So we know what he's been producing, how much he's been producing, how much he's getting paid. So we do all of that. So yes, it's a complex system, but what I'm telling you, it's not impossible. There's much more complex systems in the world today that are not related to sustainability that track a lot more data than what we are tracking. So these are systems that we haven't invented something completely new. What we're just doing is we're putting some systems together and working with rigor and discipline to make sure that the data going into those systems is validated as often as we can.
Yeah. But what I find astonishing is the sheer amount of technology and data gathering and assurance behind one bar of chocolate. You could probably actually microanalyze the entire journey that bar of chocolate I had on Sunday night took.
Yeah, we can.
I think what's interesting, what you've just said, is that bringing that data together, sustainability suddenly means we need new data. Data we previously didn't regard as important within the supply chain, suddenly that's important and we need to know that. So what you've just said is the same as what I've heard a lot of companies saying. It's about, actually, we now need to understand this data, whether it's about bean flow, whether it's measuring energy or water usage at a particular factory. It's about, how do we get this new data and bring it together? We're not doing anything new, but it's just about rounding up data we never collected before, because we now need to understand better what's happening.
I remember speaking to another CPO of another big FMCG, and they had this phenomenal system, and it had to do with deforestation activities in Latin America on soy and beef. And what they actually were able to do is work with telco companies and see that where deliveries to a collection point, and they looked at cell phone data on where did those people come from, and it was anonymized data.
Yeah.
But then they saw that in one collection point, there was a lot of interaction between an area that was deemed a protective forest area.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of movement between that protected forest area and that collection. And then you can already make a claim that clearly sure. what goes into that collection point is not deforestation free. That's exactly what we do as well. So we don't look at GSM or cell phone data, but we do look at the size of the farm, and we look at where is that farm located compared to the protected forest in West Africa, and to make sure that none of the farms that we work with is in any area of risk. And when they are even close to protected forest, we also take some measures to make sure mm-hmm. that they build boundaries and that there is areas in the farm that basically keep the forest out and also take away the need to go into the forest. So there's so much stuff, I think, with modern technology that we can just use to make it so much better and to turn that into actual actions that we can then take. There is no lack of technology available. I think what we need is determination of solving the problem.
Yeah. It's a bit like being a detective, really, isn't
yeah,
it? It's
yes.
kind of piecing together new yeah. pieces of data to tell you what's actually happening.
Jonathan, do you think that this level of intricacy only matters to the consumer because it's chocolate, because it's an edible product, it's a foodstuff, it's a treat, it's a luxury item? Is it offsetting consumer guilt?
No, I think there's a different dynamic here because I've researched this quite a bit over mm-hmm. recent years. I think until recently, the consumer thought all the big companies were doing this stuff. That when you take something off the shelf in the supermarket, people didn't think what's happened in the supply chain. Because
sure.
we were blind, we were oblivious. We had assumed all those big names and brands that we trust, of course, they'd been looking after everybody. It's only in recent years we've seen good investigative journalism and people exposing some of the things that have happened. The climate change agenda has led that because mm-hmm. it's made people aware, but also now people are understanding some of the social impacts which go alongside that. So people are now questioning and asking and thinking a little bit more about what they buy. So I think that the consumer's been fooled, but now the consumer's getting wise and is beginning to make purchasing decisions based on knowledge of what happens within the supply chain. Pascal, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree to an extent. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really hard. I mean, I'm a consumer myself, and I look through supermarkets probably with a different eye than most consumers. But still, I find it quite hard to pass judgment on every product that's on the supermarket shelf and to know what's behind it. And I think it's quite hard if you look at either certification stamps or yeah. whatever companies say, is that you can't put that on consumers to make a judgment about whether that supply chain and that brand and what's behind it, whether that's been done well or not well. And I think regulation plays a role in that. And mm-hmm. I think supermarkets, retailers play a role in that. But I think for consumers, you're putting almost too much responsibility on yep. somebody that takes 7 seconds to decide between which brand of detergent you're going to use or which chocolate you're going to eat today or which potato you're going to put on your plate today. I mean, it's really difficult for a consumer to make educated decisions on every single product they buy every day.
Yeah. How do you go about communicating your requirements of what you need the supplier to do? So I'm guessing there's a minimum things you need in place. And I'm guessing with some suppliers, they'll need to improve. So how do you engage with the suppliers and the original farmsteads to help them improve and perhaps even get involved in taking them on that journey?
Yeah, so I think the cocoa industry, like many food products, go through big traders and big trading houses and processors. And we're a bit of a pain in the ass for them because what we ask for is that everything needs to be segregated. Mm-hmm. And we will basically manage where the cocoa or where the product comes from before it goes to the processors. And not many companies do that. The way I always express this is the thing that we work on and that is grown for us in Africa, we push that through the supply chain and we track it. Most companies are sitting, and most chocolate companies or either food product companies are sitting on the other side, thinking they can change it by just changing their demands to their suppliers. We're doing it the other way around. So mm-hmm. we're basically building a supply chain from the beginning and then pushing it through the supply chain versus just saying to our suppliers, this is a problem. Can you fix it for us? And that is quite a different way of thinking about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In that way, I don't have many trust issues, but I don't really trust my suppliers to fix this thing that hasn't been fixed for the last 100 years. So yeah. You got to fix the problem and then see how you can get access to the problem that you fixed.
It's time to Ask Jonathan.
And today's Ask Jonathan comes from Mariana Lopez in Argentina, who writes, I have read your books.
Ah, good. Well done. Thank you very much.
That's always a good way to start an Ask Jonathan question, isn't it? I like them very much.
Good. Yes. I like that too. Yes. I'm liking Mariana.
And want to do what you write about, except here in Argentina, I don't find companies that have the procurement you write about. It must get better to do these things. My question is, what can I do to start to help my company have this good procurement?
Okay, this is a really good question because we sort of make the assumption that the whole world is doing strategic procurement. So when we talk about things like category management or supply relationship management as part of the everyday, there are whole swathes of the planet that just haven't got near to these things and are still just trying to buy well. So I think the thing is, you've got to take this one step at a time. Don't try and start with implementing something like category management because you just won't do it. Unless the organization is ready to do that and everybody's going to support that and resource it, it's just not going to happen. I think you've got to start with the principles of what makes buying work well. So a lot of the things that you'll see in the books give you some of the models to build from, and in particular, the Buyer's Toolkit book, which is the basic tool set. That would be a good place to start because one of the key tools in there is figuring out what your needs and your wants are. And that's a very good place to start. Just in terms of everyday buying, be really clear what it is you're trying to buy. So what does the organization need versus what does it want? And can you challenge those things? Because if you can be clear about needs and wants and challenge why are we doing it like that, you begin to question. So questioning is a great place to start. Needs and wants and question. But ultimately, you've also got to bring this back to what is the organization trying to achieve overall? And then how does that thing that you're trying to buy help the organization achieve that? And what do you need and want from it? So that's a really good place to start. Just start by being really clear about the requirements that you're trying to fulfill and just challenge, because then you can gradually work up from there and introduce new concepts and look at the power and the leverage you might have and begin to go from there.
Really good question from Mariana. In Argentina, I have absolutely no knowledge of business practice in Argentina, but it makes me ask the question, does culture play a role in all this?
Culture certainly plays a role in how we negotiate. Culture plays a role in the relationships that we have with our suppliers. So in the UK, in the US, in parts of Northern Europe, our relationships are based upon legal contracts and they're based upon an arm's length relationship. You go to parts of Asia and the Middle East and the culture is very much about relationships. And into South America, more about relationships. And those are more important than the contract we have in place. So culture absolutely drives how we have relationships with our suppliers. Doesn't necessarily drive the degree of procurement sophistication or how advanced it is. That just seems to be a product of different territories of the world having advanced at different rates because perhaps companies have come from different backgrounds.
Really interesting. Thank you very much. And if you've got a question to ask Jonathan, here's how to get in touch.
Ask Jonathan. Email your question to jonathan@theprocurementshow.com. You might be part of the next show. The Procurement Show. The latest thinking, the greatest insights.
Would you say that supply chains are getting shorter because of the ability to track data and go out and see things for yourself? And is the concept of vertical integration the only real way to be in control of what happens right back at the start of the supply chain?
I hope things are getting shorter. And I mean, I've been in procurement for 20 years and for the last 10, 15 years when sustainability has become more and more a prevalent issue, people have said, well, it'll get sorted because supply chains will get shorter, there'll be more visibility and things will be better. And in some areas, definitely a lot of progress has been made. And in some areas, there's no progress at all. So I think what we see in cocoa is the progress is just not there, where if you're talking to the garments industry and you're saying, I need to know in which factory my shoes are made or my clothing is made. And I think there's a lot more progress made in those areas. Although I would still question whether they've done everything possible to solve the issues on social and pay standards in their supply chains and if consumers are actually aware of what takes place in those supply chains. So I think in a way it's become shorter, but I still don't think it's clear enough and it's transparent enough for consumers or regulators or anybody else to really pass a verdict.
I'm picking up the feeling, both yourself and Jonathan, that you don't have general confidence that everything's being done that should be being done.
Well, the facts speak for themselves. Mm, yeah. So no, definitely not.
Yeah. We talked a lot about the social impacts and we've talked a little bit about deforestation, but can we talk a bit about the potential environmental impacts here as well? So do you have to think about things like agricultural practice back at the original growers or any other environmental impacts in the world of chocolate?
Yeah, we do. I already said a little bit about deforestation free, right? So deforestation in West Africa has been a massive issue. And I think in your opening speech, you already highlighted that there's a lot of hectares of classical forests deforested in the last 20, 25 years because of the need of growing products and the need of providing livelihoods to local farming families. So environmental problems are very prevalent. And I think that's where probably the industry has made the most progress in the last couple of years in terms of setting standards on EUDR. And I think what we see is that due diligence and that traceability is starting to now take place where at least people need to be accountable and knowing that their cocoa is not coming from deforested areas. Now, there's other things that I think are still really important. If you look at carbon accounting and carbon emissions, clearly when you buying cocoa and you can't claim and you can't prove that you're deforestation free, you have to take into account a lot of carbon emissions for your company in terms of the deforestation element of that carbon release that that comes with. For us, that's not the case. But still, what we see is that there's a lot of agricultural practice that can be improved. And the inherent fact of that is when you're a smallholder farmer and you're having 2 hectares of cocoa trees, and that's basically 80% of your income, and you have very little means to improve that you can imagine that there's a lot of farming practices that can actually improve the emissions and the practices and good agricultural practices that can even reduce those carbon emissions even further. We're currently running on a program and a process to see if we can do carbon insetting, where we can work with regenerative agriculture, but we can also do carbon sequestration by planting a lot of shade trees and putting trees back into the ground, into those cocoa farms. And in that way, you almost can create a carbon neutral cocoa supply chain is our current thesis. We're not there yet, but that is the thesis that we're working on, because that is also part, right? And I think we always say you can't do social justice on a broken planet. And these cocoa farmers are living in areas where climate change is real. We've seen a massive, massive crop failure last year, mainly due to El Nino and the changing climate conditions. And that is hitting these farmers incredibly hard because they're suddenly losing 30% of their crop, right? So climate and social circumstances of these farmers are not two different things. They're one of the same. They are combining into, if you're a small farmer, you're not making enough money and suddenly your crop is going down, you don't have opportunity to become resilient or to do things that are better for the planet. So for me, social justice and climate sustainability are one and the same. You have to find solutions that can bring both together, and only then can it work.
I'm really enjoying this. I'm learning an awful lot here. I'd like to address the whole discussion head on and just pose the question, shouldn't the industry be doing all these things anyway? Yeah. And because they're not, why aren't they?
I cannot speak for anybody else. So let me just say that clearly I think everybody should be doing this. We don't want to be competitive. We don't think that this is something that makes Tonies unique. It shouldn't make Tonies unique. Regretfully, it does make Tonies quite unique. But what we've created is an entity called Tonies Open Chain. So what we have done is we've said, well, listen, we've got a model, our 5 sourcing principles. We've got these results. We think it's working well. It isn't perfect, but it's better than anything that we've seen so far. That is also recognized by external companies and NGOs looking at the models. And we normally come out quite on top of everybody else in terms of the program that we're doing. So what we've done is we've created an entity that makes this available to anybody. It's called Tonies Open Chain. And we're allowing other companies in and say, please come in. We will help you and we will manage your cocoa supply chain and run these programs for you so that you can have the same positive outputs, you can have the same impacts to these cocoa farmers as we're having, because we believe we can only change an industry. Our mission is to change the industry, it's not just to be good for Tonies. And by changing the industry, it means you have to invite others in. So we've created that entity called Tonies Open Chain. We currently have more than 20 mission allies that have joined, most of them in the last couple of years. So Waitrose has gone out and has joined us in the UK. We have Albert Heijn in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. We have many other private label retailers that have joined us, but we also have Ben & Jerry's. Ben & Jerry's have looked mm-hmm. at this and said, we think what you guys are doing is great, so we want to join you. And last year, we onboarded Feastables, which is a fast-growing chocolate brand in the US founded by Mr. Beast. And yeah, we're so proud by being able to work with others and help them create a sustainable cocoa supply chain, that we think that's the way to go. So I'm very happy that many other companies are recognizing the need to do something. And yes, we would like everybody else to be doing it, right? We think there is no competitive advantage in being the most sustainable brand. That should not be a claim that anybody wants to make, right? Mm-hmm. That just means you're, what do you say in the UK, the tallest dwarf, right? You don't want to be the tallest dwarf. You want an industry to be built on the right foundations.
Yeah. So let's just take another moment there, because that's another one of those whoa moments. That's the second on this show. What Tony's Chocolonely are doing with the Tony's Open Chain thing is you are openly inviting your competitors to take advantage of the thing that gives you the competitive advantage, which blows my mind. It completely goes against what companies do. I'm reminded of what happened, I think, in the early 70s, maybe in the late 1960s, when Volvo developed the three-point harness system, which went on to save literally hundreds of thousands mm-hmm. of lives. So they invented this, they patented this, and they said, we can't keep this to ourselves. They opened the patent up and to all the other manufacturers and said, here's the patent for the three-point harness. This is what you now need to be putting in all your cars. And that single move gave away what would have been a thing that gave huge competitive advantage to Volvo, to all of their competitors for the greater good, which is exactly what Tony's Chocolonely has done right there. So Pascal, what do you think the chocolate industry looks like in 5 years' time in sustainability terms?
My wish or my hope is that if you look at that 2.5 million cocoa farmers in West Africa and 1.5 million children doing illegal work, that really my hope is that a big chunk of that is finally going down, right? We've seen increases in that for the last 20 years. I don't know how ambitious that can be, but I think in terms of what we are seeing in our growth trajectory, I'm hoping that that number of children in child labor will be below 1 million. And that is a scary number, right? Mm. You're still having 1 million children in cocoa in illegal labor in West Africa. But I think realistically, that is a good aspiration to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is a scary figure.
It is a scary figure.
You really have given us all food for thought. And when I think of food, you know where I'm going with this.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah. I often think about takeaways. So what are your three takeaways from this conversation?
The first one is still the awareness that people have on the issues in cocoa or in any other supply chain is still very limited. So I think, how do we together continue to raise awareness, be outspoken about the issues? That's one takeaway around how do we continue to be better in even more outspokenness, even more creating more awareness and holding people to account. I think the second takeaway is I really enjoyed the questions you've asked. And I think the fact that you're contemplating and shocked and in a way inspired, I think also shows that hopefully we're on the right track. And I think for all procurement professionals out there, my takeaway is this is, you know, many problems that we're facing are solvable problems. You just have to work towards a solution. And I would really wonder, like, are we all really clear on what the real problems are? And are we really standing up to the solutions that we know are out there?
Brilliant. Just before we go, I just want to reflect on one fact, and that is, at the last reckoning, we've got over 100,000 listeners to this podcast. Mm-hmm. Just imagine if every single one of those decided to buy Tony's Chocolonely over brand B, that we would actually all collectively be helping to eradicate child labor in the supply chain. Just going to leave you with that thought.
Very well said.
Because Pascal, it's been enlightening to have you on the Procurement Show. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, and we really wish you every success as Tony's Chocolonely continues to be this global success and this global sensation that it is. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Procurement Show. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn, search for The Procurement Show, and on Twitter, @Procurement Show. Visit us at theprocurementshow.com. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organizations around the globe. Copyright Positive Purchasing, all rights reserved. Produced by Fresh Air Studios.